My wife Doris is back in the back, and we're going to be co-teaching this workshop on parenting. We have three children. Mark is 23 and just graduated from college with a degree in electrical engineering this year. He's living at home, working full-time, started full-time yesterday on his electrical engineering job. And he's involved in a Bible study and evangelism with some of his friends. Our daughter Amy is 22. And Amy is the program director for the girls' program up at Eagle Lake Camp this summer. And she's really enjoying that. And then we have a boy, Robbie, who is 17. And he's a junior in high school. And he's also working full-time as a cook's helper over in the kitchen here at the Glen. So those are our credentials for teaching the workshop. We feel like God has been very gracious to us with our children. And they've been a real joy to us, and they're, we feel, doing fairly well. And as we've thought about why that is or what we have done, a lot of what we will share is not things that we premeditated and did consciously as the children were growing up, but they're things that we've looked back on and decided this is what we did, and this was good or this was bad. And so we're going to share from our experience what we actually did, as well as some things that we feel are principles from the Word. Several years ago, we did an exhaustive Bible study on the subject of parenting. Took a complete concordance and tried to find every verse in the Bible that had anything to do with raising children. And the first thing that stood out was that there aren't very many verses that speak specifically about raising children. There were the ones that we found, we felt, fell into four categories. And so we're going to cover this session using those four categories. And if you'll look at your handout, you'll see that the four categories are godly living, setting the example, and by far the majority of the verses that we found fell into this category. They had to do with the importance of our setting the example in godly living. And then discipline, the purpose of discipline. And there were a lesser number of verses there, but that was number two on the list as far as the number of verses. And then number three, where is number? Number three was training, the bottom of page two. Discipline and training are related, but there is a difference. Discipline is dealing with those bad characteristics that need to be taken out of the life, and training, we feel, is dealing with those good things that need to be put in. So they're really two aspects of the same thing. And then the final topic, which we have incorporated really as a subsection of number one, had to do with prayer. There was quite a bit related to the importance of praying for our children. So that's kind of an overview of what we're going to cover. We feel that it's a very key subject because there are 6 million children born in the United States each year. And how they are raised really is the key to what's going to happen to our country in the future. And the number one problem we feel in the family is the silent, passive husband who is not taking his responsibilities as the head of the home. And so we're not going to talk about that because this is a subject more on raising children, but it does impact the raising of children, that we husbands need to recognize the responsibility God has given to us to be the head of the home spiritually. We should be taking the lead in providing the spiritual training and the discipline of the children. When I was a single person here at the Glen, one of the privileges I had was serving on one of Rod Sargent's fundraising teams. And we went all over the country visiting people, and we had a little machine that had a film strip in it and a record, and we'd show some aspect of the Navigator's work, and then we would present the financial needs and give people an opportunity to make a financial commitment to the Navigators. And all over the country, we would go into people's homes. And I remember it was so interesting to me that when we would get to the place in the presentation where we would give them an opportunity to respond concerning whether or not they felt God was leading them to have a part financially in helping the Navigators. And we were trained by Rod Sargent to address that question to the head of the home, the husband. So we would say, well, Mr. Waddles, you've seen our presentation and you've been involved with the Navigators in a Bible study, and we're wondering now if God has been laying on your heart the possibility of having a part financially in helping the Navigators. And I would look at Mr. Waddles and I would say that, and Mr. Waddles would sit there, and pretty soon Mrs. Waddles would say, well, yeah, I think we ought to do that. I think that would be a good thing to do. And so then we would address the next question was, have you a figure in mind, Mr. Waddles? And he'd sit there, and Mrs. Waddles would say, well, I think, honey, don't you think we ought to give $25 a month or something like that? And I'd say, well, that's really wonderful. Would you like to make your first gift now, Mr. Waddles? And the wife would jump up and get the checkbook. And Mr. Waddles was not the head of the home. And it happened over and over. So often we would address these questions to the head of the home, and the wife would take the lead and answer. And I don't think she was doing it in a rebellious or an attempt to usurp power that wasn't theirs. They were filling a vacuum. Somebody had to do something. And since the husband wasn't doing anything, the wife was forced to take the lead. And so often this is the case in the family, isn't it? That the husband is not doing any training, he's not doing any discipline, he's not really assuming his responsibility. So the wife, by default, has to do it so that at least something gets done. So we husbands need to assume our responsibilities in this area. And being head of the home is not so much a privilege as it is a responsibility. Okay, let's start looking at this first section on godly living, setting the example. We had the privilege of being in a church pastored by a very godly man by the name of Joe Aldridge in our younger days. Joe Aldridge is now the president of Multnomah Bible School. And he comes from a very godly family. I think there was 9 children or something like that, and a very godly mother and father. And his earliest recollections of his father are seeing his father out milking the cow with a little stand that he had made to hold his Bible beside him. He'd be sitting on this stool milking the cow, and he had his Bible on this little stand, reading his Bible while he was milking the cow. That's the very first recollection that Joe has, or that's the first recollection that he can remember of his dad, is his dad reading this Bible. And so the example that we set as parents is very important. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 40. Deuteronomy 4:40, therefore you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you this day, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God gives you forever. We're told here that if we walk in obedience to God, that it will go well with both us and our children after us. Or Psalm 103, verses 17 and 18. Psalm 103, 17 and 18. But the steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to those who keep his covenant and remember to do his commandments. So God has promised a blessing upon those who fear him and who walk with him in righteousness, and that blessing will carry over to our children. Or Proverbs 14:26. In the fear of the Lord, one has strong confidence, and his children will have a refuge. So there are many promises like that that say that if we walk in obedience to God, God will bless our children. Doris is going to come up and share some things with us now on the importance of praying for our children.
Well, probably the most important ministry that we'll have with our children is that of prayer. Because we pray for them before they're born. We pray for them all the time they're growing up. And then when they're grown up, we pray for them all the rest of their life, that the Lord will direct them and lead them in the way he would have them go. And just a couple verses along the line of praying before they're born, you're probably all familiar with the story of Hannah, how she was barren and she prayed to the Lord that he would give her a son. And this verse is her answer after the Lord had granted her request. She said, "For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition, which I ask of him." And so, you know, Hannah actually got her son by praying to the Lord. And so that is something, I think, for us to keep in mind, that we need to pray, even before they're born, that they will walk with the Lord and follow him and do his will, be his servant. And then another verse is Lamentations 2:19, which I really like. I think it's the, you know, kind of the heart of what it means to pray for your child. "Arise, cry aloud in the night, at the beginning of the night watches. Pour out your heart like water before the presence of the Lord. Lift up your hands to him for the life of your little ones." They're only little for a short time and they grow up. But I know there are often times, as I think back now on my kids, that I was praying for them in the night watches and in the early morning hours and through the day, just as things would come up. And you know, you don't quite know what to do. And so you say, "Lord, you know, give me wisdom to know how to handle this situation." And it seems like God always does. So we need to pray regularly for them, asking specific things, not only for their walk with the Lord, but just for the everyday things of life. You know, school, friends, relationships with other people, activities, just all kinds of things. Nothing's too small that we can't take it to the Lord and ask him to lead and direct. And then there are often specific things that come up. There are problems that children have that we just don't know how to cope with at times. And we can go to the doctor and get advice, and we can take them here and try to do everything that we know, and it just doesn't seem, you know, like anything works. One of our children had trouble with constipation when he was real little. And we just tried everything, you know, and everything. And nothing seemed to help. And it went on for years and years and years. And I can remember often just, you know, saying, "Lord, you've got to, you know, help this child, because I don't know what to do about this. I mean, I don't know how to help him." And the doctors didn't really seem to be able to help him either. And I just think, you know, over a period of time, the Lord did meet that need. So those, you know, and there are all kinds of things. You might have a child that's given to temper tantrums. And, of course, you can apply the rod. That helps. But sometimes you just need to pray about those things, too, and ask God to intervene in the life of that child. And God does that. And then there have been some specific promises that I've claimed for the kids. One especially is Colossians 2:8. You're probably familiar with that. And as I think of my kids, you know, starting out in school, and I knew what kind of philosophy they were going to be exposed to and teaching, I wanted to get there first, and I wanted God to be giving them discernment as they heard teaching, that they would be able to discern the truth and compare it with what they were being told and come home and ask me questions about it, you know, not just start thinking, well, I'm not sure this is real. And we've had some very good discussions about, you know, philosophy and why we believe in God. And this verse is one that I've claimed along that line, Colossians 2:8. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men and according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. And that is so true, isn't it, in our world? I mean, they go to school, unless they're in a Christian school, they are going to be exposed to man's way of thinking, that man does everything and that God is totally left out. And we'll get into more of that later, because our kids have been in public school all their time. So we didn't necessarily try to keep them away from that, but it gave some good opportunities for discussion. And then I think of a verse like Isaiah 54:13, the promise that all your sons shall be taught of the Lord. Just praying and asking God that He would make that true in your children's lives, that each one would be taught of the Lord in His timing.
Thanks, Doris. I don't know how many of you caught Terry Taylor's little comment yesterday morning when he said, God is not looking for creative people to go out and do creative things for Him. He's looking for obedient people who will go out and do His will. And I think that if we spent more time praying for our kids and less time trying to figure out in our minds what to do, that more would be accomplished. One of the main areas that I think is key in raising children is our quiet time. We need the fellowship and the renewal, the daily renewal of our fellowship with the Lord, in order to maintain our own walk with Christ in such a way that we are an example for our children. We need the strength that we get from renewing our fellowship each day in order to enable us to maintain the kind of attitudes and demeanor that we need as we go through the hectic routines that our children sometimes put us through. So we need the quiet time for our own nurture and building up. But also, our quiet time is a fantastic example to our children. Have you had the experience of getting up to have your quiet time and your child gets up and comes and sits beside you, maybe with their little Bible picture book or something like that? Well, I have. And I think from the very early years, Amy, our daughter, would imitate me. She'd get up and have her quiet time. And she became very faithful in quiet time and continues to be very faithful in quiet time. And I think part of it was just our example in getting up and spending time with God. And they see that and they observe that. There's something there. Then in the area of Sunday school and church attendance, we feel it's very important to set the example, not just to take them to Sunday school, but to go to Sunday school ourselves, so that we don't take them and drop them off and then come back at church time, but we go and participate ourselves, so that we have never had a problem with our kids not wanting to go, because we have always just gone with them. Then in Bible study, back to Sunday school and church. Sunday school and church obviously is only a supplement to their spiritual training. We can't depend on the church to be the primary supplier of spiritual nurturing to our children. It's only a supplement. It can be a very great help. And we have chosen our churches during the younger years of our children primarily on the basis of the quality of the program that they have of Christian education for the young people. But it is not to be the primary source of Christian input. Next point is Bible study. We feel that Bible study should be a normal part of a Christian home, and the children should observe that the parents are involved in a Bible study. Maybe the Bible study group rotates around and meets in our home occasionally and then other homes. And then also as the children get old enough, we begin to have Bible study with them. And usually this was initiated by them. Sometimes we have had to initiate it, but oftentimes they have wanted to study. And so we've done primarily individual studies with them because they were quite a difference in age. And we either I would study with one or Doris would study with one. Last year, we had a family Bible study for the first time, really. And it was very profitable. And what we did, we took our kids were all teenagers or older by then. We used the Navigator Discipleship Journal. I don't know how many of you get the Discipleship Journal? Okay, a few. It's a very well done magazine with articles relating to Christian discipleship that Nav Press puts out. And the articles are also designed to be used as Bible studies or Bible discussions. So we would take one article a week and we'd all read it and then we'd get together and discuss it. And that turned out to be a very profitable thing that the kids really looked forward to, and it hit vital topics. Witnessing should also be a normal part of a Christian home. And our children should observe us setting the example in witnessing. Witnessing to our neighbors, maybe having evangelistic teas where we would invite people over, or witnessing to our relatives on vacation time. And we've had some very interesting times. Doris comes from a large family. Most of them are not Christians. And when we go on vacations, we often get into quite heated spiritual discussions with her brothers. And we've learned that after a certain length of time, those are no longer profitable to continue. And so one day, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago now, we were in one of these discussions with 3 or 4 of her brothers, and we both arrived at the point where we realized that it was becoming an argument and it wasn't going to be profitable to go any further. So we just kind of backed away, and we had not really noticed that our children had been kind of sitting around the perimeter of the discussion and listening to all this. And as soon as we quit, they stepped right in and really started going at it with her brothers and did pretty well. In fact, one of her brothers said, "You know, your kids make better points than you do on these things." So we were quite encouraged. Another area is giving. Giving should be a normal part of a Christian home, Christian giving. And we have discussed our giving with our children for their training. And we have family councils where we would talk about things like this. And so our children knew what our giving was and why we would do it. And about 5 years ago now, I was managing a company out in California. And I felt the Lord led me to resign from that company and to come back into a position with the Navigators. But my daughter still had one whole year of high school, and we had moved her in the middle of her high school experience out to this situation. We didn't want to move her again twice during her 3 years of high school. So we decided to quit and trust that God would provide some kind of employment during that year before I was available to come back and assume a responsibility here with the Navigators. And as we were discussing this as a family and what we were going to do and how we were going to cut back on our expenses, our daughter said, "Well, one thing for sure, we don't want to stop our giving program." And we were very encouraged that in the light of this situation where I had just quit my job and we had no means of support at that time, they felt that it was important to continue our giving, which we did, and God provided all our needs that year in a very interesting and fun way. So these are some of the areas that we feel it's important for us to set the example in godly living for our family.
Put it down here. Okay.
You guys are having fun, aren't you?
Okay, the next point, love. Titus 2:4 says, "Let the older women teach the younger women how to love their husbands and to love their children." I've always thought that love, especially for a child, was kind of just instinctive, that, you know, we just had that naturally, especially as mothers. But I'm, after thinking about this verse, I don't think that's true. And I think there is a special kind of a love that we get from our relationship with God that enables us to love our children in a way that apart from God, we couldn't do that. And I think of what Lauren Sanney has said, that the greatest thing you can do for your children is to love your husband or your wife. This is part of that example, that they see us, they see our relationship. And when you think about the kind of relationships around them, they see other families and couples, they see all the divorces and the breaking up of homes. They really need to see that love relationship between a husband and wife. They need to know that, you know, you're going to stay together. You're not planning to, you know, take off at the first difficulty that comes along. And I think mainly they just see it in daily living, how we relate to one another. You know, are we short with each other, or do we yell at each other, or do we get in big fights? All that affects them, and they learn about marriage by watching us. And then Howie Hendricks has said in his book, Say It With Love, one thing I ask God for concerning my children is that they will know I really love them. So we need to communicate that love to them. And how do you communicate love to your children? You know, our love is not going to be always keeping them happy and making them feel good. Because as a parent, we're going to have to do some of the things that are hard. We're going to have to say no to some of the things that they want to do and that they want to do bad. But we know what's best. And so it's holding them to a higher standard than just, you know, making them happy and giving in to them. And we need to demonstrate our love. And I even think of my kids, the ages are that they are now. They still like to have me, you know, pat them on the back or ruffle their hair, or my 17-year-old lay down across my lap and he likes me to scratch his back. You know, all of that is just part of knowing that they're loved and we're really concerned for them. And it just seems like they, you know, they really need that. It's not hard when they're babies to cuddle and rock them, and, you know, babies just, that's the way they are. But when they get older, I think you have to be more creative, because they don't want you showing your love in front of their friends, especially when they're teenagers, usually. And then one of the things that our oldest son said to me, he had gone through some kind of difficult experiences and probably felt like he wasn't really pleasing us. And he said to me, Mom, I know no matter what I do, that you still love me. And that's just from God, you know, that kind of feeling that he would have, that even though he might turn his back on God or do something that would be totally wrong as far as we're concerned, we still would love him and accept him. And then another way to develop love is just to have fun together. Just those things that you do that make you a family. You know, playing games, camping trips. In Colorado, skiing is a big thing. And we've spent a lot of time with our kids skiing, and we've discovered that was one thing. Even our teenagers, they didn't get tired of going skiing with us. They won't go other places with us, but they'll go skiing. And hiking and developing family traditions. We make birthdays a big special thing in our house. You get to choose what you want to eat, or if you want to go to a special restaurant or something. When they're young, it was a real simple thing, like our youngest would always say, I want macaroni and cheese. Well, that was a nice, simple dinner. And we decorate the chair, you know, make signs, and that's your special day when it's your birthday. But that type of thing, just developing those family traditions so that they will remember when they get older and as they think back on their experiences growing up, those things will be special to them. Ours often talk about our camping trips. We had a little travel trailer, and we went to the East Coast and, you know, saw all the different historical sites, and that's special to them now. They talk about, remember when we did that, and we were in that city, and we did this and so, and so that's the kind of thing. And then humility. Here, again, is just our example. We have to be willing to admit that we're wrong, that we've goofed. You know, a lot of times we have to apologize to them. for something we've done. If we've lost our temper, and we shouldn't have, then we need to, you know, apologize and make it right. And that's just an example to them of how we are submitting to God, I think. That's how they learn about, they see God at work in our lives by the way that we're willing to admit our wrongs. And then honesty. That, again, is just they're observing us, watching us. I'm sure you've had experiences like us where you've gone in a restaurant and you've, you know, went to pay your bill and either they didn't charge you enough or they charged you too much. And we've had where they didn't charge us enough, you know, and so we've said, well, that's not right. You know, we owe you more than you have on the bill. And the kids saw this, and now we see them do this sort of thing. So you just never know. These little eyes and ears are open all the time, taking in everything you're doing. It's kind of scary when you think about it, except you know that, you know, God is directing your life, and He'll make up for those times when you're blowing it. And then speeding. It's amazing how, as soon as they learn to read, they can read the road signs, you know, and you'll be going 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit, and they'll say, "Hey, Mom, how come you're going 35 in a 25-mile zone?" You know, and they just pick that up real quick. And so we kind of have to watch ourselves, don't we? And then we've kind of made a thing about Santa Claus, that we didn't really tell them there was a Santa Claus. We emphasized the birth of Christ and built our Christmas around that and told them that the story of Santa Claus was just a story. So they never really, you know, believed in Santa Claus. That's kind of hard for grandparents and some of the relatives to think, oh, those poor little children, they don't get to believe in Santa Claus. But we were afraid that if we told them that Santa Claus existed and then later on told them that it was just a story, and we also tell them about Jesus, that they might think, you know, that's just a story too. So we wanted to be real clear on that. And then attitudes. And again, this is just, you know, our attitude, the kind of attitude we have is what how they learn. Our respect for authority. Again, this is things like, you know, when it comes time to pay our taxes, are we moaning and groaning about, oh no, you know, why do we have to pay this? Or is there some way we can get around it? Just our attitude and how we approach it. Or like the police, you know, are the police our friends? Or are we always kind of, oh no, there's the police, you know, am I going too fast or am I doing something wrong? And children pick this up. And so we need to be careful about how we talk about these things. And then the pastor of the church, you know, coming home on Sunday after the sermon, sitting around the dinner table, you know, are our comments positive and building up and encouraging and saying, well, that was really a great sermon that ministered to my heart and sharing something that was a blessing to me, rather than saying, well, I'm not so sure he was kind of off today. And, you know, our kids just don't need to hear that from us, do they? But it's so easy to just fall into that trap unless we're really walking with the Lord. And then respect for the property rights of others. And I'm sure all of you have had experiences where, you know, you've either seen people's rights infringed on or someone's infringed on yours. We were living in England, and in England, your yard or your garden is very private, and you don't go in other people's yards without permission. And these friends of ours were playing ball out in their yard, and it just bounced over the fence, and, you know, they just come over from the States, so they just hopped over the fence to get the ball. And the English neighbor saw them, and he was quite upset. He opened his door, and he came in and said, what are you doing in my garden? You know, he was very offended to think that someone would, you know. So we need to learn and fit in with what's right around us. You know, it could be the apple tree on the way to school in the little old lady's yard that everybody helps themselves to on the way to school. Well, I mean, we need to train our kids, hey, we don't do that kind of thing. You know, that doesn't belong to us. And, you know, you could ask permission if you felt like you wanted one, but the best thing is just not to, you know, take advantage. And I think it's really easy to just start infringing on other people's rights without even realizing. And you remember when pop cans had these little caps that used to flip off? Now they've made them so they go down in. We were camping up in Oregon one time, and I saw a few of them laying around, and I thought, well, I'll give the kids a nickel, you know, to pick up for each one they find. I thought there was about 10 or so, and, you know, I spent $5. You know, we did leave the campground better than we found it, but you have to be careful about those kind of things. But just, we have, and as we've camped, we've tried to make that a policy with our kids, that always leave the campground better than we find it. Maybe, you know, leave some wood stacked for the people when the next people that come, and be sure and take all our trash and things. Just that kind of thing. And it just becomes a part of them. They don't even think anything about it later on. And then the value of school. I think in this country, we have a tendency to think that school is the social club, or, you know, that's where they're supposed to do their social activities rather than getting their academic training. And so we really need to encourage them to do their very best in school. Now, not all our kids are going to be A students. That's true. But we should encourage them to work up to their potential, whatever that is. And, you know, if they are having difficulties, we need to try to help them with that difficulty, to overcome it. And if we can't get satisfaction with the teacher, then maybe go to the principal and really be in it with them. And I read this study that said 4% of American high school students take calculus. Compared to other countries, that's a very, very small percentage. And you probably think, well, you know, most kids wouldn't use calculus. But just the training of your mind, you know, just to make yourself study something like that is a good experience for you. And so encourage your kids to take challenging courses, especially in high school. Don't just, you know, get by with cheerleading squad and at sports and that type of thing, but really encourage them to make those days count, because when they get to college, if they've applied themselves in high school, it'll be that much easier. I don't know about you, but I just had a ball in high school. When I got to college, I thought, oh, what's happened? It was very difficult, you know, and I think if they apply themselves more in high school, they won't have that trouble later on. And then always be positive about your children's teachers. I have a very negative example. We had this history teacher, and I was not very impressed with him. And I made some comment at home. Mark had had him, and then Amy was having him the next year. And I said, well, I just don't think he's very good at motivating his students. And Amy went to school and told the teacher that her mother did not think he was very good at motivating his students. And I think he felt a little insecure anyway. And so when I found out that this has happened, I had to go to him and apologize. I told him, you know, I was really wrong to have made that comment in front of my children when he was their teacher. And it ended up, so we had a very good relationship. But that's the kind of thing, you know, that it's just so easy in everyday life. It comes off and you're not even thinking how important it is. Also, my daughter probably shouldn't have said that, but she's one of those people. And then respect for the rights of children. I think we need to listen to our children. Not only what they're saying, but what they're feeling. We need to draw them out. Proverbs 20, verse 5 says, counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, and a man of understanding will draw it out. And so we need to become masters at drawing our children out. I have found that, like, right after school is the best time to be available to talk to my kids. As soon as they come home from school, it seems that's when they want to tell you about their day. And if you're not there, you just don't, you know, by dinner time, they've forgotten what happened at school, and they won't tell you. And so you just need to really work at finding times when you can draw them out, and you need to give them your attention. I think of our youngest when he was probably about 2 or 3, and there was a lot of activities going on. We'd all be talking and everything. Pretty soon, he'd want to get my attention. If he couldn't get it, he'd take his hands and put them on my face and turn them like this, you know, Mommy, listen to what I'm going to say. And that's, you know, I think it's really easy for mothers to kind of turn off. You know, you've got all these things going on, and so you don't really listen to what they're saying. And So it's something we have to work on, isn't it? And then let them have their own possessions. You know, let them have their own little things. Develop early a responsibility for, you know, these are my toys and my special thing. They might have to share them with a friend, but they need to feel like there are some things that are theirs. And then if they can have their own room or their own private place, if that's possible, but, you know, like school age, where they can feel like they can do what they want to do and that you're not going to be coming through and going through all their things. And I think it establishes a trust. They know they can trust you. Even after they get into school, knocking before we enter their room. I think it's just a courtesy. And it helps them know that we respect them as people growing up. And our home should be a place of refuge. You know, it's so easy to always be seeing the things they're doing wrong and picking on those things instead of when they come home to have an encouraging word and just letting them relax and unwind. And they really need that after the day out. Who knows what they've been exposed to? And then the tone of voice I use. You know, how do I speak to them? My children early on would be very good at saying, "Why are you so mad, Mommy?" Or, "Why are you so mean?" And I think, uh-oh, you know, my attitude is coming through badly. And, you know, that just how we speak to them, I think it's real easy to take children for granted and think that we can just rattle off at them, and we can't. We're going to reap a benefit from that. So we need to speak lovingly to them. And then Ephesians 6:4 says, "Fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath." But I also think that's something that mothers can do too. Joe Aldrich used to say that this provoking to wrath was a continual picking or an overemphasis on the negative. It discourages the child from ever hoping to please his parents. And so we just need to be careful that we don't overemphasize the negative. You know, we see them and we think, oh, if they could just learn how to do this better, or if they just wouldn't tease their brother or sister so much, or if, you know, and we try to change those things by these little nagging things, and it doesn't seem to really do any good. I think that's a place where I feel now as I look back, I would just pray more and try not to give so much negative feedback into their lives. Okay.
We have learned by experience that we have more material than we can cover in a session like this. So we have decided to skip lightly over the section on discipline, because there's quite a few books and quite a bit of talk about discipline. And we feel that we'd like to major more on the training part. But just a couple points on discipline, and that's that it needs to be tailored to the age and the individual nature of the child. And so it varies. What we would do with a young child for discipline would be different for the different children the same age, and then it would be different for that child as it got older. And we used a wooden spoon when they were younger for the two boys, but with our daughter, the wooden spoon was totally ineffective. She seemed to have a very high tolerance for pain or a very strong will. I'm not sure which, but you could just beat on her, and it had no effect at all. But we found that by withholding her dessert at meal, she would just collapse and just crumble into tears. So you have to find out what is most effective with each child. Her dessert was very important to her. And with the older children, it moves from punishment to withholding privileges. Once they learn to drive, you have a wonderful opportunity to exercise discipline and control by withholding that privilege of using the car, or withholding the privilege to watch TV, things like this. So we have done things like that, and our goal in discipline has been not to enforce rules, but to teach principles. So we want them to learn why they can't just run out in the street when they feel like it, or why they can't watch a certain television show, or why they can't go to a certain movie, or why we don't do this in our family, where other families may feel that's okay. So we've tried to teach the principles. And then to expect obedience. I think this is where we fail so often. We don't expect them to obey. We tell them something, but we really don't think they're going to do it. And they can tell that we really don't think they're going to do it, and so they don't do it. And you've, I'm sure, seen or been involved in the exercise where the parent says, would you please carry out the garbage? Nothing happens. Billy, I thought I told you to carry out the garbage. Nothing happens. Billy, when are you going to carry out that garbage? And the garbage goes out, because he has learned that that's the point where you're going to take some action if he doesn't carry out the garbage. Now, when I first met Leroy and Virginia Imes, who were my spiritual parents, the first night I was in their home, they invited me over for dinner. And after dinner, we sat around and talked. Leroy and I did a little Bible study. And then at 8 o'clock, Leroy said, children, it's 8 o'clock. And the children stopped what they were doing and went up and went to bed. And I'd never seen anything like that in my life. You know? We fought and argued and negotiated and everything on bedtime. He said, children, it's 8 o'clock, and they went up and went to bed. There was no yelling or screaming or anything like that. They had been trained. I said, how did you get them to do that? I mean, I've never seen anything like that. He said, well, you should have seen some of the sessions we had when they were younger, teaching them what would happen if they didn't respond to the first command. He said, there's no reason to have to give three or four commands. The children hear and they understand. And if they know that when you say it, you mean it, they'll learn that. So that's a very hard thing to maintain. And we need to work at that all the time. We'll have some time for questions at the end. And if you'd like to go into any of these other areas of discipline, we'll be happy to try and answer questions or discuss it. Probably another area that is often a problem is consistency between the parents, so that both Doris and I have the same standards and are expecting the same level and quality of performance, so that they don't play one against the other. If they know mom is firmer on this and dad is kind of easy, then they'll learn that pretty quick. So we need to be together, and we need to spend time discussing and praying about what standards we're going to have and what we are going to do in the area of discipline. And then to be consistent from day to day, so that what's a standard today is a standard tomorrow, and so they don't get confused by whether we really mean what we say or not. These are the problem areas primarily for the parent. Not the children. Children don't usually have that much trouble with discipline. It's the parents that have the problem exercising it consistently and fairly and explaining the reasons. Let's go into this area of training. Remember, discipline is dealing with those natural traits which are bad and have to be dealt with and brought under control. And training is building in the good things. So let's look at Proverbs 22:6, which is our favorite verse on training. It's a very well-known verse, and you know there's been some new interpretation of the verse. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. The traditional way to think about that verse is that if we build those things into a child that we think he needs to learn when he's young, when he's old, he'll continue to do those things and continue to go that way. But the newer translation of the verse, which I think is more helpful and more relevant, is to find out which way God intended that child to go and then train him in that way. Don't train him in the way you think he should go. or don't train him in the way that you went, but what unique characteristics and gifts and bents has God put in that child, and help develop those so that he is trained up in the way he should go, not the way necessarily you want him to go. You may be an engineer, and you may think that that's a great career for your children, but your children maybe are prepared by God to be artists or musicians or accountants or something like that. And so we need to find out what gifts and bents the child has and train him in those things. Training our children is the most important ministry we will ever have. We've been given that responsibility by the Lord, and there's pretty clear instruction in the Word that if we have failed in our job of training our children spiritually, that we are not qualified to be involved in training other people spiritually. Our number one responsibility is our children. And we're working not just for a little sketch, but to create a masterpiece, to develop the full potential of that child. And time goes by so quickly. We need to make the days count while we have those children with us. And we need to, if we don't apply effort and energy and direction, it will just not happen. We need to consciously be involved in training our children, not just living our life and hoping they will catch it. As Doris and I look back, our oldest is now 23, and it seems like it all happened so quickly. We feel very fortunate that they're all still home and that we still have them with us, and we're enjoying them more and more as adults. We feel it's tragic how often children leave home as soon as they graduate from high school. They go away to college, or they go away to the military, or they go away and take a job somewhere. And the high school years are not usually the most harmonious and smooth and joyous in the relationship between the parents and the children. The children are learning to be persons on their own. They're testing your authority. They're venturing out in the world. And there are frictions and tensions. And one thing we've discovered is that having the children stay home, actually we moved away from our son, and he stayed here and went to college for a couple of years, and then we came back. But basically, and our daughter went away for 1 year and came back home. Basically, they've been home. And as adults, staying in the home after those high school years, we didn't plan it this way, it just happened, we've developed a new relationship with them as adults, which is a very delightful and we feel helpful thing, so that when they do leave home, it will be after a period of really good relationships. Our kids didn't have bad relationships in high school, but they're much better now with the college ones. And the one in high school, he's now kind of feeling his oats and testing this and testing that, and they go through that in the high school years. Doris?
Self-esteem. First of all, I'd like to recommend Chuck Swindoll's book, You and Your Child. His chapter on self-esteem is excellent, and it's much more complete than anything that I can say. Well, I personally feel like his book is very, very good, but especially the chapter on self-esteem. And our goal in self-esteem is, of course, to make them feel good about themselves, to recognize that they have a purpose and a worth in existing in our world. And I think, first of all, they have to learn how to contribute to the family before they can start contributing to our society. And if they see, you know, that there's something in them that we value and that they're good at, then that makes them feel good about themselves. And so that gets us to individually, we have to look at each child. And I think this is where we need to go to God and say, Lord, give me the wisdom, like James 1:5, you know. If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask God. Ask God for the wisdom to see that child, to see what his strengths are, to see how God has made him, so we can best develop them. And I don't know any other way, you know, than just asking God and then being sensitive and alert as they do different things. And, of course, we have to let them try lots of different things and expose them to different things. And I don't know about your kids, but I had a couple that they would never try anything new. I mean, they'd be perfectly, you know, they'd just stay at home. And I had to say, well, I think you need to go out for the swim team. Let's go down to the swimming pool, you know, take them by the hand. Let's go down and we're going to try it. And after one time, well, that was kind of fun. Yeah, I think I can do that. And our older son tells about how his dad said to him when he was in eighth grade, you know, there's going to be a NAV Bible study for teenagers. Maybe you'd like to go. No, I don't think I'd like to do that. And Bob said, well, yeah, come on. I'll take you over there. And so he took him and he said, well, after one time, it was kind of fun, you know. Just give in. There's also the danger, I suppose, of pushing them, you know, too hard, saying, well, you've got to be in soccer and football and basketball and track. And, you know, that's not possible. I mean, we need to let them be children and kids, but we need to help them try new things. You know, ice skating, roller skating, bowling, you know, music, art, just all kinds of things. We need to help them try those things. Another thing is to major on their strengths and not their weaknesses. As I mentioned before, it's real easy as parents to see the weaknesses. You know, we see the child who doesn't seem to be able to make his bed, and he doesn't seem able to get his clothes on straight, and, you know, he just takes him forever to get back from school, and you're thinking, oh, what is this? How is this kid ever going to make it through life? We had one of those, and it would take him a half hour to get home from school. And I think, I don't, and, you know, and then maybe he'd leave his jacket someplace, or his hat, or a shoe, or who knows what. And I think, how could you forget your jacket? I mean, you know, here it's cold outside. They're just totally oblivious. And I would think, I don't know. We used to say, well, we don't know what he's going to be when he grows up. How will he make a living? And yet, you know, now he's an electrical engineer, and he's got it all together. But, you know, when he was growing up, I couldn't see that. I mean, I just thought this kid was hopeless at being forgetful. And I realize now that he's very intent on one thing, and he thinks about that. And it might have been when he was walking home from school that he was looking off at, you know, the creation around him, and his hat fell off, and he didn't even, you know, he was all involved in something else. Anyway, you know, not all those things that we think are bad are necessarily bad. So try to major on the strengths and not their weakness. And then try to help him understand what his bents are and the way God has made him and gifted him. And that's hard to do because it's not easily detectable. We have to really, I think, work at that. Our oldest son, we didn't discover until he was graduating from high school that he had a very high math aptitude. And he had just kind of, you know, breezed through high school, didn't really apply himself, and we weren't aware of it. I don't know what we were doing exactly. But we're sharing our, you know, things we did wrong too, so maybe you won't do those same things. But just that type of thing, if you can try to figure out how God has put them together and made them. And then develop his abilities to his maximum potential. Don't let him settle for, you know, less. You know, if he's going into swimming, well, really encourage him. And, you know, maybe get him on a swim team. Or if he's a runner, you know, let him get involved in all kinds of track meets. And if he likes to paint, have him take a art class, you know, and or music lessons or whatever it is. But expose him to lots of different things. Don't just limit their... Or don't say, well, I never did those things, so my child doesn't need to do it. Because they might have a totally different, you know, gift or bent than we have. And I think by the time they're teenagers, they really do need to have one or two things that they really feel good about doing themselves, that they feel like they're better. I don't think it's a thing that builds pride, but it just makes them feel like that they can exist in the world because they can do some things a little bit better than, you know, their peers. And with our oldest, it was swimming. And he wasn't a great swimmer, but, you know, he was better than just the average kid, so he was on the swim team, and that was really a good experience for him. And our daughter, she's just one of these people that's been organized since she was born. I mean, you think organization is something you learn, but she's one of those people that just had it. And, you know, now I see, here she is at Eagle Lake organizing their little thing. You know, that's just right down her line. She loves that. And we used to take trips, the kids and I, and Bob, he couldn't come. He'd fly out later, and we'd drive from here to Oregon. And he'd say, well, if you have to make some major decision, you know, along the way, if the car breaks down or something, you don't know quite what to do, why don't you ask Amy what you think? You know, here's this girl, 12 or 13 years old, and I'm the mother. Why don't you ask Amy? I thought, But I knew, I mean, because she had a way of analyzing a problem and coming up with the right solution. And I had seen it happen over and over. So I thought, well, you know, just swallow your pride. And I don't think I ever, the car didn't break down, so we didn't have that experience. But we also can learn from our kids. And I think one thing for mothers is a lot of mothers are working now. But if you're at home full-time with your children, there are a lot of demands on you because you happen to be a full-time mom. And people tend to think, oh, well, she can be in the PTA and she can run the woman's Bible study at church and she can teach Sunday school and she can do this and that because she doesn't work, you know, outside the home. And I think it's something as a mother, if we get too busy and too involved in activities, we're going to have a hard time figuring out what our children's bents are and figuring out, you know, how they should be directed. So that's just a word of caution I would put out because I feel like that was something I struggled with kind of my whole life, is often feeling guilty because I would say, no, I don't think I better take on that responsibility. I feel like I should be at home with my kids. And people do not understand that. But it's worth the price later on. And then you don't quit ever. Even as they get older, you continue, that training keeps going on and on and on. But it's encouraging to see what God does. And then training in the Word. Bob has mentioned that when the kids were young, usually at their suggestion, we would do Bible study with them, maybe the Navigator Studies in Christian Living or whatever it is that they really would like to do. And we don't think you should force your children, you know, we're going to do Bible study and we're going to memorize Scripture it has to come from them. Because I think if we try to push things on them, they might react. And I've seen children that have, you know, they don't even want to go to church anymore because it's been so pushed on them. So it has to be something that they want. And if you don't see a spiritual desire in your child, that's a place where you can pray that God will give them, you know, a spiritual desire, because he can change their hearts. And then as they get into the teen years, to encourage them to be in peer group Bible studies. Because usually by that time, you as a parent are losing your authority or you're not as important as you once were. And they just need that input from other people. And often, you know, it'll be a youth worker in a church or in a young people's group that'll have a real impact on your child. And so you want to get them exposed to those situations. And then family devotions. Oh. Satan really fights us there, doesn't he? He really tries to keep us from getting that time that we need with the kids. We've tried to always keep ours very simple. We have not used really books or very creative things. We've just read a portion of Scripture and had a time of prayer. And when they're young, you know, it's just two or three verses. And as they get older, you can lengthen it out. And then one of the things we used as an incentive to read was once you learned to read, you were given a Bible, and then you could read the portion at family devotions. And that seemed to be a big thing with our kids, that, you know, they could read the Bible, family devotions. So that's And Mary White has an excellent book. They've changed the title, and I don't know the new title, but it's on family devotions or family time with God. That's another excellent book. And then another thing we do after we read is we let them express their any needs that they have that they want to pray about. It might be a sick friend, or it might be a test at school, or something that they're concerned about. Everybody gets to go around and share their prayer requests, and then we pray for those things. And I think this helps them see, God answer prayer too, because we pray for them, and then they see how God is answered. And in the matter of training, I think it's just what Bob said earlier, and church is just the example. As they see us go, they will go. And I don't know what your situation is, but like for us as Christian workers, sometimes it's really easy to feel that if we've been involved in a conference, say for a weekend, that we've had enough spiritual impulse, we just won't go to church and we'll let the kids go. Well, we have felt very strongly that we shouldn't do that, that we should take our kids to church, even though sometimes it doesn't seem the best thing for us, it is the best thing for them. So just make sure that you're consistent in your own example. And then using practical life illustrations. Joe Aldridge used to call this the interpreter of life. He said these are just unplanned, unstructured situations that come up, through the day or whatever is going on. Something happens, and this is a way of teaching them truth. And when our kids were in school in Southern California, they had a teacher who had a nervous breakdown, and everybody knew about this. And this teacher was real kind of a negative person, and he made fun of the Bible. And we did, explain to our kids, when a person doesn't walk with God, this is the type of person that they become. They're not pleasant and things go wrong in their life. Things go wrong in the lives of Christians too, but God is with you to get through the experience. And this teacher used to make fun of the Bible, and there were several parents that were quite concerned about this, and some of us got together and we wanted to do something about it. And one mother said, well, she had talked to him, and he had just taken it out on her child in the classroom. So we decided to go to the principal. I think there were about four of us. And we told the principal that we were using the Bible to teach our children, faith in God. And we didn't appreciate it being shot down in the classroom, especially in elementary school. And the principal agreed. He said, oh, no, he shouldn't be doing that. And so he talked to him. And the next day, the teacher apologized to the children and did not make fun of the Bible anymore. And I think it was a good thing for the children to realize that, there was a respect for the Word of God, and this teacher had to back down from where he was. And then sometimes you can use family problems, like if you have a divorce situation, that's another time of explaining to your children that, because we're not walking with God and doing what He wants us to do, these kind of things happen. Divorce and problems in a family. And then it couldn't just be something like a child being afraid of something. Like one of ours was very afraid of swimming or water, and that was really hard for me to grasp that, because I had been a lifeguard and a swimming instructor when I was single, and here I had this child who didn't even want to go near the water, and he said, oh no, I don't want to take swimming lessons. And I said, oh, well, you have to take swimming lessons. And he said, I don't want to. And I said, well, what if you're on a ship going across the ocean and, the ship starts to go down? What are you going to do? Well, I won't ever go, I won't ever go on ships. I mean, he was quite sure that he didn't want anything. So I said, well, you're going to have to take swimming lessons. And I said, Jesus will be with you when you go to your swimming lesson, and He will help you get through it. And He'll be right there with you. And I would go over the verse in Joshua 1:9. Have not I commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed. For the Lord thy God is with thee, whithersoever thou goest, even to the swimming pool. Even if you have to jump off into deep water. Even if you can't swim, He'll be with you. And we'd do this one day, and then the next day, oh, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back. And it probably went on for 3 or 4 days. Every day it was, we'd pray, go over the verse, and we'd go to the swimming lesson. And after 3 or 4 days, he learned to swim in the water enough, you know, that he realized, oh, it's not going to hurt me. And he got through that. And then after about 2 weeks, he joined the swim team. You know, so we just have to. But this was a situation where, you know, I think using the word helped him get through that. And then we had a time in California where we decided that cold cereal was very bad and we shouldn't be eating that because it had so much sugar and not very much nutritional value that we were just going to cut that out of our diet. We'd have granola or something like that. And this, our youngest son loved cold cereal. I mean, that was just practically a mainstay of his diet. And when he heard we weren't going to have any more cold cereal, I heard him praying. He said, Jesus, would you tell Daddy to let me have some cold cereal? I thought, oh, no, now what are we going to do? Because, you know, I thought, well, I know we're not going to change, you know. And about this time, we had a staff conference out in California at Palm Springs, and we served breakfast in the motel room for the staff. And we bought these huge cases of these little boxes of cereal. Well, after the conference, guess what? We had 4 cases of these little boxes of cereal left over. And we couldn't just throw them away, could we? You know, we had to use them. And so we brought home the cereal, and he got to have cereal. So God answers prayer. So those are the kind of things, just to let them, you know, see God work. And then training and responsibility. Am I getting... that's your section, right? I didn't copy.
I'd be happy to let you go ahead and teach that.
No, you didn't.
We've really majored on training our children in the area of responsibility because we feel that's so key to life. And some of the areas that we've worked on are the value of money, how to handle money. And what we've done is try not to develop expensive tastes too soon. Keep them in McDonald's or Wendy's as long as possible. Bob owns some Wendy's restaurants here, so I have to change my illustration. Keep them in Wendy's as long as possible. Don't let them find out there's such a thing as a waitress who'll come and take your order and all this. And, we have found one of the most helpful ways to develop responsibility in handling money is to give them what we call a clothes and activities allowance. Now, when they were younger, we gave them an allowance that they could spend any way they wanted to. It was, you know, just a small amount of money. But as they got older, and especially when they entered high school, Doris kept track for a year how much we spent on each child as an average on clothes and activities. And so we gave them then that amount of money and let them manage it themselves. They buy their clothes, they decide what activities they want to go to. And it's interesting how different ones handle it different ways. Our oldest son saved his and didn't buy any clothes. And it got so bad that Doris finally had to withhold some of his clothing allowance and buy him some underwear. Otherwise, he would have had nothing to wear under his clothes. Our daughter, excuse me, bought material with hers and sewed and made hers go a long ways. And our son, Robbie, now, he's a spender, and he will spend it as fast as he gets it. And we would advance them several months' allowance at the beginning of the school year in the fall so that they could get their wardrobe and everything. And he would take the maximum that you would let him go on credit for. So they're all different, and they manage their money differently. But we felt it was a very valuable experience for them to have to realize that you just can't have all the Adidas shoes and OP shirts and this type of thing that you want, that there's a limit, there's only so much money available, and you decide how you want to spend it. You can have this or that, but then you suffer the consequences of your decisions, and that's how we learn, isn't it? Another thing along the same line maybe you've driven out here with your family. And along the way, you go into a restaurant, you know, and the kids are, they don't want to order on the kids' menu. They want to order on the adult menu, and they want to order the most expensive dinner and this type of thing. And there's this hassling, and should we go to Wendy's or should we stop at this other restaurant? And what kind of a motel are we going to stay at and this type of thing? We found that we solved all that problem, plus added to the training by giving them a trip allowance. And they buy their own food, and some of them will save it and then blow it all in one big meal a day, or some will have, you know, three nice meals or whatever. But we let them decide, and it takes all the hassle out of wanting this and wanting that when we're on the trip, because they can have whatever they want as long as it's within the money that they have, that we've given them for a trip allowance. When they got old enough to drive and began to use our car, we charged them a car mileage allowance so that they began to learn that the car is not just something that's free, but there's a cost to using the car. And we actually calculated what it cost us to operate the car. I don't think we charged depreciation, but we charged gasoline and oil, and it worked out to 8 or 9 cents a mile that they had to pay when they used our car. So they learn responsibility that way. We always try to encourage them to save and lay money aside for the things they wanted. And we taught them how to manage our bank account. Each one took their turn when they were in high school, balancing the checkbook and taking the bills and writing the checks to pay the bills. And then we would sign the checks after they got it all done to make sure it was all done right. But they learned how to do these practical things in managing finances. And it's interesting now how they will call around all the different banks and find out which one's offering the best terms and everything. So they've really learned how to shop around and manage their money. In fact, we feel we may have overdone it a little bit in managing money. Our two older children both have more money in the bank than we do. And we can't get them to spend it. They still negotiate with us now, you know, what are you going to pay on college? And we have agreed to pay their tuition and their books and provide room and board if they stay at home. If they decide to go away to school, this is assuming that you have a good college in your locality, which we do. If they decide to go away, then they will have to pay their own room and board, but we'll still pay the tuition and books. And we'll do that for 4 years, so we don't want them to drag it out. And then after 4 years, they're on their own. Another thing we've done is to have them pay their own recreational expenses. We learned this out of necessity because our kids really enjoyed skiing. And living here in Colorado, that's a big sport, and it's a good family recreation, but it's also quite expensive. And we couldn't afford take the whole family skiing very much. So we said, if you want to go skiing, you work and save your money, and you pay for your own lift tickets, and we'll provide the housing. We'll provide the food. They even paid a share of the condominium. If we went away and rented a condominium or a motel, they would pay their share of the housing and buy their own lift tickets. And that way we could afford. And we've had some wonderful family vacations that way. In fact, it's become a kind of a family tradition that we take a winter ski vacation. But they also learned responsibility. And back in the early days, the kids had an assembly line in the crawl space under the house where they would assemble Navigator topical memory systems. In the old days, the topical memory course came in a box with about 21 different parts that had to be assembled and put in this box in the right order. And the Nav Press paid, I think it was 7 cents a unit to assemble these things. And our kids would work all winter to save money for their ski vacation. One area in which we pay is for church and spiritual things. If there's a youth retreat or if there's a book that they would like to read, a spiritual book, we didn't want them to not do these things because of financial reasons. So we pay for the retreat, we pay for the book, whatever expenses there are that they want to be involved in spiritually, we wanted to encourage that. Doris?
The necessity of work. You're probably all familiar with the verse in 2 Thess 3:10 that says, if a man will not work, neither let him eat. And we have often quoted that verse around our house when someone said, well, I don't feel like doing this. We said, well, there's lots of times we don't feel like doing things, but we have to do them anyway. And we started at a very early age giving them family responsibilities or chores to do. When they're 2 and 3 years old, they can empty waste baskets and they can do kind of a dusting job. And that's what they started out with. And then as they get older, their responsibilities have to increase. I think one of the mistakes that we commonly make as parents is we tend to get in a rut and we think, well, that's your job and, you know, it's your job for 15 years. And they get bored with that. They want to have variety. And so you have to be thinking of new things that they can do and ways that they can help. And then encourage them to have jobs outside the home. Our kids have had paper routes, you know, babysitting, nav materials, like Bob mentioned. They've worked as janitors. And then working in a restaurant during their high school and college years, the restaurant work was really great for them. They worked in a really very nice country club, and they were exposed to a different probably caliber of people than they'd ever met before. But that was an experience that was really valuable for them. It helped them, I think, learn about people. And also, this restaurant made them really work hard. If you didn't work hard, you were fired. And they weren't very concerned about their employees, really. But I think they really learned a lot through that. So help them get jobs outside the home. But I might just add on that don't apply for them. You know, if you say if they want to get a paper route, we'll encourage them to call the paper and make the arrangements. Don't you do that for them. Or if they're 15 and 16 and you have a friend that has a business that they might work in, have them go and apply in person. Don't you as the parent call, because they need that experience of learning how to get a job on their own, because you're not always going to be around to, you know, break the ice for them. And also, if it's for a friend, they already have an advantage, you know, in that they know that you're a friend, this is your friend's son. So encourage them in that. And then Lawrence Annie told Bob that if he had something to do over, he would spend more time working with his kids, not just telling them what to do, but he'd do more things with them in the way of jobs. And then when you give them jobs to do, expect high standards. Don't let them get by with, you know, a half-washed car or dirty dishes or, you know, partially clean bathroom, but make them redo. Our kids have spent a lot of time redoing the car or rewashing the dishes or something. So, you know, really maintain a high standard.
Another area we've worked on is how to make decisions, because this is a key part of life, how to make good decisions. We try to teach them the decision-making process, that you need to get the facts and think about it and pray about it, get counsel from other people, and consider all the possibilities and then make your decision. And one of the ways we've done this is in family council. We would have these periodically, maybe every couple months, and this would be the time when we would do family planning. We'd plan our vacations. What are the options? And what would you like to do? And what would you like to do? And go through the decision-making process with them in these family councils and let them have a say in our vacation plans. And in major financial things, we would discuss these in family council. Should we buy a different car, or should we keep this one for another year? This type of thing. We'd go over this to teach them how to make decisions and also what factors were involved and why we do the things we do the way we do them, to let them learn. The way we gave them their clothing and activities allowance, made them do their own shopping and learn how to shop. And we tried to teach them not to just go and buy the first thing they see, but to go to two or three stores and compare prices and then make their decision. Just this week, you have to be prepared for mistakes that they will make, because that's how we learn and that's how they learn. And our son, with his first paycheck from working in the kitchen this summer, decided he wanted a stereo for his truck. And so he went out and he did shop. He shopped two or three places, but then he waited a week and was not aware that another store was having a big sale, so he went back and bought the one that he had looked at before, and then he found out that there was a much better buy at another store, but he couldn't return it because there was a 20% restocking charge. So they learn by actually doing these things. But we need to let them make mistakes. As I mentioned earlier, our goal in training has always been to teach principles rather than rules. And in order to do that, we have to be willing to answer questions. And we have to be willing to let them ask and question what we do and why we're doing it. We know that there are some parents that feel that if the child is asking a question, it's questioning your authority, and that you should not allow that. We don't feel that way. We feel that we want to have a very free and open atmosphere so the children can ask questions about anything. And ours do. Sometimes people, if they were to hear the conversation around our dinner table, would think the children were very disrespectful, because they will question us and actually push us for reasons and question our reasons and everything, and we don't feel that's bad. We feel that's good, that they're learning, they're trying to find out what truth is. And if we can't defend our decisions, and if we don't have good reasons for our positions, then maybe we need to go back and rethink and look at what we believe. Maybe it isn't right. And we have been challenged to the point where in a few cases we have had to admit that we really didn't have a good reason, and that we were just operating out of habit, or maybe the way our family did. And when you really listen to them and hear what they say and try and answer their questions, sometimes you have to back down. And that's a good thing. There's nothing that improves the relationship with your kids more than for you to admit, you know, I was wrong. And you've really got a point there. And for them to realize that they've been able to be heard and make a point, and that we admitted when we were wrong, really, you think that is going to undermine your authority as a parent, but it really fantastically improves your relationship with your kids. Lets them know that you're real people. One thing that we have really been very strong on is the matter of lying. It's much worse to lie about something than it is to do it. If you have taken the car and speeded or something like that, or if you nicked the car, we don't make a big deal out of doing something wrong like that, especially if it's a mistake or an accident, or if it's a first-time thing. But if they try and cover it up and lie about it and say, "No, I didn't do it," that is that's the worst thing you can do, is to lie about something. We want them to be honest and to admit when they've done wrong. And the Lord forgives us, and so we try and be forgiving to them if they are honest about it. And we also try not to tempt them more than we're able. You know, the Lord says in 1 Corinthians that He will not tempt us, 1 Corinthians 10:13, not tempt us more than we're able. So that if we have, if they have done something and they have had a privilege revoked, let's say they're not to watch television for a night because of something they did or didn't do, and we have a Bible study somewhere else, we would not leave them home and say, "Okay, now you are not to watch television tonight because that's your punishment." That's too much temptation to put them under. So we would say, "Well, you're going to have to not watch television, but we're going to be gone tonight, so we'll do it tomorrow night when we're home." And so that they're not tempted beyond their able to say, no, I didn't watch television when they did while we were gone. So try not to, we try not to tempt them more than they can bear. And then we're going to skip over to just some final comments on Christian versus secular schools. And we know that this is a very controversial subject and a subject that people feel strongly about. And I feel like I can speak about it because for several years now I've been an elder at the church here in Colorado Springs that has the largest Christian school in town. And for 2 years I was chairman of the elder board. So in essence, I was responsible for the largest Christian school in town, which has almost 1,000 students. However, we have never sent our children to a Christian school. And the reason is that we wanted them to learn to deal with the issues that they were going to face, the challenges to their faith. And we wanted them to learn that at a young age. It depends on the school. There was one point in California when the school was so undisciplined, the school that Doris was talking about, that we almost put them in a Christian school. However, God intervened and we moved back here before we did that. It also depends somewhat on the child. Some children can handle more challenge to their faith than others. We have been very fortunate in Colorado Springs, in our area, to have very good public schools with lots of Christian teachers in the public schools and even for a while a Christian principal in our public school. And our high school that our son goes to now has a Christian principal, a lady. And so you have to just not automatically write off the public school. And we feel it's been a helpful and a positive thing for our kids to go to the public school. Also, there's the matter of being salt in the situation. If all the Christians pull their children out, the situation will just totally collapse and get worse. So we need to learn how to handle the world. And personally, Doris and I feel that the younger they learn that, the better. And they have always been able to discern the difference between what a non-Christian teacher teaches and what they've been taught to believe. And they've been able to discern that the reason that person believes and teaches that is because they have never committed their life to Christ. They're not a Christian. So naturally, that's what they believe and that's what they teach. But that's not what we believe. And it has not confused them. Just to close before we open it up for questions, to share 3 John 4, there's no greater joy than to see your children follow the Lord. And we had a commissioning service for the 1985 class of missionaries going overseas with the Navigators 3 or 4 weeks ago right here in this room. And it was a very emotional experience to see Jim White, who was taking part in the commissioning service, and go to each one of the about 25 who are going overseas this year with the Navigators. But one of those is his own son. And to see Jim commission his own son for missionary service with the Navigators was a very moving experience. And there's no greater joy that we can have than to see our children follow the truth, follow the Lord. And it won't happen by chance. We need to set the pace. We need to apply energy and direction and discipline in the training and raising of those children because we only have one chance, and it goes by very fast. Any questions?